Boys and boyettes, let's discuss the shocking truth about your ego. Now, of course, why does this really matter? It's a kind of weird term by Freud and Jung that doesn't seem too relevant, but you hear everybody talk, everybody always rant, and it's like, I want to destroy my ego. I want to experience ego death, and there's sort of this religious connotation to it. You hear people being like, stop being such a narcissist. Kind of put your arrogance aside. You're so egotistical. It's all framed as like bad stuff that you shouldn't do. Well, what's so interesting about the brain is that the first reality you come across when you look at it, just for what it is, forget about talking about psychology, just look at the brain for what it is you find out that it's split in two. And that's weird. Now, the reason why it's split in two is actually quite complicated, and it leads us to draw a conclusion about the way that you conduct your life that is really creepy. Because you, of course, think that you're just one blob, you're just one mind, you're just one consciousness. And what happens is, the way the society works is that all of us are just one person, and all we need to do is stop being irrational and start being rational. You know, you could say order our consciousness, put ourselves together inside of our head. And then we can just go out there in the world and we can vote. And then the political system would formulate society to make a democratic, good society where all us rational people vote together because we're well informed, because we've got the right stuff inside of our consciousness. But that all runs on the premise that you don't have other weird stuff going on that's kind of tripping that up, that you are this unified being fully in control. But the evidence from the neuroscience suggests otherwise. So let's check out a video. This is someone who has had their brain cut in half. It's a weird, weird thing that people used to do, but they cut your brain in half to stop epilepsy. Now, watch what happens when this guy has this part of his brain, these two sides of his brain spoken to, right? So they ask for different commands off them. This is really weird. Now constantly think about this idea of the ego when we're looking through it.
Joe, I'm gonna show you some things. I just want you to tell me what you see. And here we go, you ready? Look right at the dot. Okay, right. Okay, you ready? Look right at the dot. Grapes. Good.
Okay, cool. So what's going on here? You want to know what's going on here? We put the dot in the middle and we've got two sides of our brain. And so when something flashes up on one side of the screen, it's talking to one part of the brain. You've probably heard before that your eyes are wired to the opposite side of your brain. So we can almost talk to these two parts of your brain. This guy has his brain cut in half, so these two parts of the brain sit inside his head and act as different people. What? It's so strange. So one side of his brain, his left brain, is very good with words. It loves words. It's very good with conceptualizing. And we're going to talk about how that might be the ego more in a moment. But he's able to flash car or grapes, and he can see it and he can repeat it back. All right, I saw car. Now watch what happens next.
When Joe focuses on a point, everything to the right of the point goes to his left brain, the dominant hemisphere for language and speech. So we can see here that when we flash a word or a picture, Joe is easily able to name it.
Here we go.
See it.
Close your eyes and let your left hand do a little work here. Okay, what do you got there?
Pan.
Okay. Do you know what just happened? All right. So we're talking to the left brain. We're talking to the one that's good with language, the ego, the conscious mind. And we're flashing it all these words, grape, tree, car. And it's being like, yep, grape, tree, car. And then because his brain is cut in half, we flash to the other side. We talk to the right brain, the side that he can't see with his left brain. And his left brain, his conscious mind says, yeah, I didn't see anything. What do you mean you didn't see anything? Well, okay, maybe he can't. So does that mean the conscious mind is on the left? What? That is weird. But then he is asked to draw a picture of anything that comes to mind with his hand connected to his right brain, his unconscious mind, if you will. And the damn thing draws, because it can't really talk, the damn thing draws a pan. And then his left brain sees the pan and says, oh, that's a pan. So his right brain, his other mind, picked up this word and could understand it and then draw it out. Absolutely amazing. And it can't really talk. This is why you have to draw it. Absolutely amazing. Do you have any idea what that's trying to say to you? That is fascinating. And it's not a new idea at all. It's a very, very old idea. It's a very, very old idea, but it's not taken serious as a scientific idea. Of course, Freud and Jung and Nietzsche and a lot of people brought up this notion that we have a conscious mind and an unconscious mind. Now, of course, these guys are going off intuition, so it's not taken so seriously, but the evidence is harshly backing this stuff up. I'm going to suggest that we jiggle this around a bit instead of saying up and down, conscious mind up here, unconscious mind around here. It seems to look a little bit more like we've got a left and right situation. The left hemisphere is the conscious mind that talks, that communicates with people, that thinks it knows everything that's going on, whereas the right hemisphere is the unconscious. Now, let us look at what happens when someone has a stroke and their ego gets destroyed. And you're going to find this very interesting.
Our right human hemisphere is all about this present moment. It's all about right here, right now. Our right hemisphere, it thinks in pictures, and it learns kinesthetically through the movement of our bodies. Information in the form of energy streams in simultaneously through all of our sensory systems, and then it explodes into this enormous collage of what this present moment looks like, what this present moment smells like and tastes like, what it feels like, and what it sounds like. I am an energy being connected to the energy all around me through the consciousness of my right hemisphere.
So you've heard me say before that the right hemisphere, the unconscious, is a basic bitch, a yoga girl, and this is proof. Although this woman goes through an incredible challenge of her left brain getting destroyed, so she develops a very, very vivid connection with this right brain. You'll find this absolutely fascinating. She is the Sophia, the Athena of our age.
We are energy beings connected to one another through the consciousness of our right hemispheres as one human family. And right here, right now, we are brothers and sisters on this planet, here to make the world a better place. And in this moment, we are perfect, we are whole, and we are beautiful. My left hemisphere, our left hemisphere, is a very different place. Our left hemisphere thinks linearly and methodically. Our left hemisphere is all about the past, and it's all about the future. Our left hemisphere is designed to take that enormous collage of the present moment and start picking out details, and more details about those details. It then categorizes and organizes all that information, associates it with everything in the past we've ever learned, and projects into the future all of our possibilities. And our left hemisphere thinks in language. It's that ongoing brain chatter that connects me and my internal world to my external world. It's that little voice that says to me, "Hey, you got to remember to pick up bananas on your way home. I need them in the morning." It's that calculating intelligence that knows, that reminds me when I have to do my laundry. But perhaps most important, it's that little voice that says to me, "I am. I am." And as soon as my left hemisphere says to me, "I am," I become separate. I become a single, solid individual, separate from the energy flow around me and separate from you. And this is the portion of my brain that I lost on the morning of my stroke. On the morning of the stroke, I woke up to a pounding pain behind my left eye. And it was the kind of pain, caustic pain, that you get when you bite into ice cream. And it just gripped me, and then it released me. And then it just gripped me, and then it released me.
So notice how much this is going to sound like the ego death experiences of people who take massive doses of psychedelics. Perhaps you could understand psychedelics as making the two parts of the brain talk to each other in a way that they don't usually do, and it can be quite a shock for people. There's something else in here, and it's talking to me, and it's showing me stuff. And even just listen to the way that she describes her reality changing. It's absolutely fascinating.
And it was very unusual for me to ever experience any kind of pain, so I thought, okay, I'll just start my normal routine. So I got up and I jumped onto my CardioGlider, which is a full body, full exercise machine. And I'm jamming away on this thing, and I'm realizing that my hands look like primitive claws grasping onto the bar. And I thought, that's very peculiar. And I looked down at my body and I thought, whoa, I'm a weird looking thing. And it was as though my consciousness had shifted away from my normal perception of reality, where I'm the person on the machine having the experience, to some esoteric space where I'm witnessing myself having this experience. And it was all very peculiar, and my headache was just getting worse, so I get off the machine, and I'm walking across my living room floor, and I realize that everything inside of my body has slowed way down. And every step is very rigid and very deliberate. There's no fluidity to my pace, and there's this constriction in my area of perception, so I'm just focused on internal systems. And I'm standing in my bathroom getting ready to step into the shower, and I could actually hear the dialogue inside of my body. I heard a little voice saying, okay, you muscles, you got to contract, and you muscles, you relax. And then I lost my balance, and I'm propped up against the wall. And I looked down at my arm, and I realized that I can no longer define the boundaries of my body. I can't define where I begin and where I end, because the atoms and the molecules of my arm blended with the atoms and molecules of the wall. And all I could detect was this energy. And I'm asking myself, what is wrong with me? What is going on? And in that moment, my left hemisphere brain chatter went totally silent. Just like someone took a remote control and pushed the mute button, total silence. And at first I was shocked to find myself inside of a silent mind. But then I was immediately captivated by the magnificence of the energy around me. And because I could no longer identify the boundaries of my body, I felt enormous and expansive. I felt at one with all the energy that was, and it was beautiful there. And then all of a sudden, my left hemisphere comes back online and it says to me, hey, we got a problem. We got to get some help. And I'm going, oh, I got a problem. So it's like, okay, I got a problem. But then I immediately drifted right back out into the consciousness. And I affectionately refer to this space as La La Land.
So think about how this relates to the thesis in Buddhism, that you're supposed to sit down and meditate until the inner voice turns off. Exact same process here. This is so revealing to everything that we'd understand as religion. It is unbelievably insightful because you start to see consistently all these different patterns. Even this idea of the right brain being a generalized power is very, 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 very scarily close to this notion of God. It's frighteningly close, and you're going to see this now in a moment. And we'll even talk about Nietzsche's take on that, the death of God problem as well. And it's not like, you know, silly irrational stuff. This is probably the hardest science we have about the brain. And it should just blow the paradigm asunder. It literally demolish the foundations of the modern conception of self, which we carry into Twitter and Reddit, where we think that we're these rational individuals. But we're not. And it's clear that we're not. And we've got this whole other intelligence that's able to do stuff. And this is like a drug trip for this woman. It's absolutely amazing what's going on. Her ego is dissolving and then coming back online, dissolving and coming back online. Her conception of self is dissolving, coming back online. And it's so interesting how persistent this problem is. I always talk to people who come into contact with Jung, and they have this issue with this individualism. It's like, what's my purpose? What's my mission? It's so hard to sort of say to them, it's like, I want to individuate. I want to find my purpose. I want to find my mission. It's like, bro, you know, this whole idea of you, and I know it sounds so, so basic, so, so much like a yoga class, but this whole idea of you and this magic mission that you're setting for yourself, this is literally your ego doing it. And the whole point, the whole goal is for you to destroy that, to get that out of the way so that it can integrate itself properly with the general, so it develops a relationship. And of course, listen to what she's saying here. This is the other mistake that comes from this. People get absolute, they jargonize and get absolute and left-brained about these things. Don't think of it that you just need to turn your ego off and everything will be better. It's a dynamic. You need to win the war, so you need to have your ego come online and help you do stuff, but you also need your ego to come offline and help you get perspective and connection with the felt reality of the world, the energetic world. Very interesting stuff.
But it was beautiful there. Imagine what it would be like to be totally disconnected from your brain chatter that connects you to the external world. So here I am in this space, and my job and any stress related to my job, it was gone. And I felt lighter in my body. And imagine all of the relationships in the external world and any stressors related to any of those, they were gone. And I felt this sense of peacefulness. And imagine what it would feel like to lose 37 years of emotional baggage. Oh, I felt euphoria. Euphoria. It was beautiful there. And then again, my left hemisphere comes online and it says, hey, you've got to pay attention. We've got to get help. And I'm thinking, I got to get help. I got to focus. So I get out of the shower and I mechanically dress and I'm walking around my apartment and I'm thinking, I got to get to work. I got to get to work. Can I drive? Can I drive? And in that moment, my right arm went totally paralyzed by my side. Then I realized, oh my gosh, I'm having a stroke. I'm having a stroke. And then the next thing my brain says to me is, wow. This is so cool. This is so cool. How many brain scientists have the opportunity to study their own brain from the inside out? And then it crosses my mind, but I'm a very busy woman. I don't have time for a stroke. It's like, okay, I can't stop the stroke from happening, so I'll do this for a week or two, and then I'll get back to my routine. Okay, so I gotta call help. I gotta call work. I couldn't remember the number at work. So I remembered in my office, I had a business card with my number on it. So I go into my business room, and I pull out a 3-inch stack of business cards, and I'm looking at the card on top. And even though I could see clearly in my mind's eye what my business card looked like, I couldn't tell if this was my card or not, because all I could see were pixels. And the pixels of the words blended with the pixels of the background and the pixels of the symbols, and I just couldn't tell. And then I would wait for what I call a wave of clarity. And in that moment, I would be able to reattach to normal reality. And I could tell, that's not the card, that's not the card, that's not the card. It took me 45 minutes to get 1 inch down inside of that stack of cards. In the meantime, for 45 minutes, the hemorrhage is getting bigger in my left hemisphere. I do not understand numbers. I do not understand a telephone, but it's the only plan I have. So I take the foam pad and I put it right here. I take the business card, I put it right here, and I'm matching the shape of the squiggles on the card to the shape of the squiggles on the foam pad. But then I would drift back out into La La Land and not remember if when I come back if I'd already dialed those numbers. So I had to wield my paralyzed arm like a stump and cover the numbers as I went along and push them so that as I would come back to normal reality, I'd be able to tell, yes, I've already dialed that number. Eventually, the whole number gets dialed, and I'm listening to the phone, and my colleague picks up the phone, and he says to me, and I think to myself, oh my gosh, he sounds like a golden retriever. And so I say to him, clear in my mind, I say to him, this is Jill, I need help. And what comes out of my voice is, roo, roo, roo. And I think, oh my gosh, I sound like a golden retriever. So I didn't know that I couldn't speak or understand language until I tried. So he recognizes that I need help, and he gets me help. And a little while later, I'm riding in an ambulance from one hospital across Boston to Mass General Hospital. And I curl up into a little fetal ball. And just like a balloon with the last bit of air just right out of the balloon, I just felt my energy lift and I felt my spirit surrender. And in that moment, I knew that I was no longer the choreographer of my life. And either the doctors rescue my body and give me a second chance at life, or this was perhaps my moment of transition. When I woke later that afternoon, I was shocked to discover that I was still alive. When I felt my spirit surrender, I said goodbye to my life, and my mind was now suspended between two very opposite planes of reality. Stimulation coming in through my sensory systems felt like pure pain. Light burned my brain like wildfire, and sounds were so loud and chaotic that I could not pick a voice out from the background noise, and I just wanted to escape. Because I could not identify the position of my body in space, I felt enormous and expansive, like a genie just liberated from her bottle. And my spirit soared free like a great whale gliding through a sea of silent euphoria. Nirvana. I found nirvana. And I remember thinking, there's no way I would ever be able to squeeze the enormousness of myself back inside this tiny little body. But then I realized, but I'm still alive. I'm still alive, and I have found nirvana. And if I have found nirvana, and I'm still alive, then everyone who is alive can find nirvana.
Now, of course, this should shock you. This woman is describing a religious experience, the experience of reality as some type of divine dancing place. Rumi once said that the thing you seek is seeking you, and it's such an interesting idea that when your ego gets destroyed, this other part of you that's been there helping you the whole time comes online and gives you this blissful experience of sort of this oneness and unification with the world. And you often hear people talk on psychedelics or in Buddhism or whatever they're doing, or Christianity, they have this oneness with God. In Buddhism, they have this destruction of self and this connection with nirvana. In drugs, they have this demolition of the ego and freedom and surrendering from their reality. Now, this stuff is so fascinating, and it makes us ask serious questions about religion. And so I'm going to show you this final video here, and then we're going to put all this together in relation to Carl Jung and what it actually means, because it is very, very weird stuff. So check this out.
Two human beings in one body, in one skull, two spheres of consciousness. Now, many experiments have been done on these people, and I ask myself a very simple question. Okay, you've created two people here. What about their personalities? Do they have different personalities? What about their aesthetic preferences? Does one like blondes and the other like brunettes, for example? One like chocolate and the other like vanilla? What happens? So we tried these experiments, and what we did was we had to first train the right hemisphere to communicate with us. In fact, the right hemisphere can read simple commands, simple words, simple sentences. And then you ask a question and say, point to a box, yes, no, I don't know. Because it can't talk. The right hemisphere cannot talk. But it can comprehend simple semantics, simple questions. Left hemisphere, of course, can talk. So you can present boxes, yes, no, I don't know. So we asked, for example, are you at Caltech? And the right hemisphere pointed to yes. Are you on the moon? It said no. Are you in California? It said yes. Are you asleep? Said no. Then I said, are you a woman? And the patient was male. And he pointed to yes, and then started chuckling and laughing. So at least the right hemisphere has a sense of humor. Okay. Okay, so now comes the big question. What if you ask, do you believe in God? So I said, do you believe in God? And the right hemisphere went straight to yes. Right? Asked the same question to the left hemisphere, yes, no, I don't know. It went to no. Right? So here's a human being whose right hemisphere is an atheist, and left hemisphere, on the other hand, believes in God. And this finding should have sent a tsunami for the theological community.
And so, of course, this certainly should send shockwaves throughout all of our conceptions, our understanding of the nature of the world. Everything should be shook by this, because the way that we understand the world comes through our mind. And if we discover something as fundamental as this about our mind, it should blow our heads. Of course, Jung and Freud and all them and Nietzsche, they all proposed this, but there was no evidence to support it. But now the evidence is there, and now everybody should be running around dribbling, screaming, "Boy, oh alert, I'm connecting with the ultimate juice in the sky." Now, what I'm going to talk to you about today is the reason why your mind is designed this way, because it's actually very, very rational, no less profound, but still rational, and how that works for, in the simplest level, your participation in the world, all the way up to your understanding of what religion is. And it answers quite a lot of our problems about stuff like the death of God. So the reason why your mind is split in half is because you need to do sort of two jobs. The main job you're trying to do is you're trying to survive the war of life. And nature has designed you to be a team. You need to work together in a team. And this team is made up of a general and a soldier. Okay, and so the way this works is that the general has a sense of the big picture and the soldier has a sense of the specific small picture. And this left brain is your soldier. It's also your ego. It's also about focus, like the way you get absorbed up in what you're doing, like the way you're getting into a task, you're there writing perhaps or something like that, and you lose track of time, you lose track of what's going on, you get caught up in your mission. That is your dopamine and your ego kicking in to get you to do something very specifically and accurately. It's why Jill could not see the picture, because the right brain by itself isn't really that specific. It's not good at doing this stuff. And so you can see how this team works, because the general is then able to see the big picture, able to make super plans, decide which missions are valuable, which direction to go, what are the goals and all this type of stuff. But it might find it a bit hard to get specific. The general can't run down and fight all the battles because he's just one dude. He needs to deploy people to do his job for him. And the idea is that you bounce between these two. It's a very, very sophisticated way of dealing with things. And of course, you need to understand evolution for this to make sense. You are an evolved being, and the nature of your mind has been constructed in such a way to give you coordination, but it's not necessarily perfect. This is our imperfect solution. We split ourselves in half, and we have two presences inside of you trying to achieve something, and they're trying to work together. Now, of course, what you consider you is this. You're full of dopamine. You're Rambo. You're the soldier full of cocaine. You are a wild man. And you are trying to get to the end goal. You don't really care about much else. You just want to get the job done. That's all you care about. Now, there's a bit of an issue with this, because as great as that is and as specific as that is, it lacks perspective. Imagine if you think the job is to take over some town and it's a stupid idea. Maybe it's a civilian town. There's no real soldiers in it. You end up going to doing something dangerous or stupid. It's a problem. The ego can get bad missions. The ego doesn't understand the big picture, doesn't understand the nature of the war. And so this is why we have this right brain. And this right brain is full of negative emotions, full of negative anxiety receptors, that it's able to freak you out and get you to stop. But it generally is quiet and stands out of the way. And this is the weirdest thing of all. It's conscious. It's aware that you... Well, first of all, it's conscious. That's the scariest thing. It's in the other part of your head. You don't really have access to it because you're the ego. And it is able to see what you're doing, whereas the ego is not able to see what the right brain is doing. It's not really able to participate in the right brain's mode of consciousness. The ego is sort of obsessed with itself and one-sided, whereas the right brain is holistic and actually understands the soldier. It's so strange. So the general understands what the soldier's going on. He can trace him, but the soldier doesn't really know what the general is up to. And he only really hears from the general when he gets a call or he gets an order or something like this. And this is what tends to happen. The general's going to stay out of your way. The general's not going to bother the soldier being like, yo, what's up, man? How's life? The general's going to step out of the way and let you do what you got to do and not make you really aware of its presence. And you'll get absorbed and what you're doing, and then say you do something stupid, you run into a dangerous town, and the general will fill you up full of negative energy because it knows it has the big picture, fills you up full of negative energy, the anxiety, and that will start as an intuition, you know this, the gut feeling that there's something wrong, and then it'll snap you out of it. And if you keep on pushing, it will come in like a voice, the conscience, that says stop. And that'll be like the general calling you up on the field phone. Stop what you're doing. Pause. And so ideally, this makes perfect sense. You and the general are working together to take over the world. That's so scary because both of these people are inside of you. You and the general are working together to take over the world. And you, me and you, we're talking to each other, but we're just two egos. But inside both of us, there's something bigger and more profound. There's two generals inside of us. It's so scary. But of course, it's exactly what Freud and Jung were talking about. And even as great as Freud is, Jung's sophisticated model of the psyche, when you jiggle it a little bit, actually is so on point to what this was like, because he went through these two sides of his brain communicating. Just like Jill, it seems like some religious experience that she's having. Think about what happened to Jung in the Red Book. It was like the destruction of his ego, a psychotic break, and then it felt like all this really profound stuff was shooting into his mind. And from that, he builds his model of the psyche, which is quite accurate. He was like someone studying, you know, it's like the way Terence McKenna studies the psychedelic trips. All these things are quite interesting. He's studying the experience of this communication going on from inside his mind before he had the scientific evidence to understand what was happening. So again, I would always suggest we twist it side to side instead of up to down. But still, think of what he models here. He says the ego is the mission creating soldier, obviously. It's conscious, the center of your experience. Obviously, it's what you think is you. This persona is seeing yourself as the soldier. Jill, for example, was saying that when she gets really in touch with the right brain, she loses her individuality. Well, that's absolutely fascinating. Unbelievably fascinating, but we'll talk about that more later because that's a religious problem. Of course, what this right brain then operates as is this doorway to the unconscious, perhaps the unconscious itself. Perhaps there's, well, God knows how crazy this stuff goes. But nonetheless, the most important factor is that it's outside of normal experience. It's not you. It's the thing beside you or around you or behind you that's watching you, that's awake and alive and aware and participating in the world outside of your realm of experience. And it has a character and personality, and it's doing stuff. You should close the laptop and run around naked on the streets after this. That's what has to happen now. And think about what happens when you are denying this, when you're ignoring the general. He has to build up more negative energy. He has to scare you more. He has to spook you out. Stop doing your little egotistical mission. You're doing the wrong mission. You don't have the big picture here. Don't. You're running into danger. Fills you full of negative energy. And that's the shadow, the spooky thing. The world starts to turn evil. The right brain starts to grab your perceptions and twist them and make you scared and make you doubtful and make you doubt yourself. Very fascinating. Very on point. Think about this idea of the anima. Remember what Jill was saying, where it's the right brain is more in touch with the energetic world. And of course, people are always talking about meaning. I need a purpose. Very egotistical perspective. What's my individual purpose in this world? What's my mission statement I can tell people? Oh, my purpose is that I'm a good person and I'm doing this big war and I'm fighting this big mountain and all that. But what you're looking for is never necessarily an egotistical purpose, although your ego certainly is. But what you want, what your being, what your soul wants, what your actual feeling reality wants is you want to feel vitalized. You want to feel that the world dances with you. You want to feel connected to the world. You want to feel connected with the people around you. You want to feel the power of creativity shuttling out of your body into the world. You want to feel that connection. And of course, the left brain, the ego, is actually unfeeling. It's a little bit dead in terms of its feelings, a little bit mechanical. It's a machine designed for constructing missions. And like a soldier, it's designed to take a load of cocaine, go cold, and just achieve goals and get angry when it can't. That's all it's for. It's like sort of like the Terminator. But the felt experience of the world is coming from the right brain. It's what energizes you, what gives you the felt experience. And this is, of course, what Jung was saying. This anima, this soul comes to him and starts speaking to him. Very, very logical when you think about it. Even think about the ancient Greeks. They had Ares, the cold, heartless warrior, the murderous warrior, the high testosterone warrior. They appreciated him, but they also saw Athena, the goddess, female goddess of war, the strategic goddess, the goddess of Athens, as superior, as the leader. And that's, of course, the extremely healthy dynamic of Ares, the Rambo soldier, who is problematic but still important. And then, of course, Athena, the sort of feminine general who makes decisions. Very interesting take. Because, of course, what does the general do? What is the kind of characteristics of the general? He's a weirdo. The soldiers look at him and he walks out and he grabs a load of mud and rubs it between his fingers and goes, smells like napalm in the morning or something like this. And they're like, oh, this guy's a psychopath. But of course, he makes good calls. He knows more than you do. He's getting all this intelligence. He's getting this information about the weather. He's getting the mood, the morale of the armies. He's got a bigger perspective, bigger than you. And of course, this is the experience of the self for the wise old man. This unconscious, its role as an intelligence that can coordinate and guide you, that is separate from you, appears like a personality in your head that's smarter than you. And that's actually true. It appears as the wise old man, the coach. You know, you're a boxer and you have a coach who can't do it. He's not potent enough to fight. You're the one who deploys, but he sees the bigger picture. He sees some of the mistakes you can't see. That's how the team works. And it's the same with Athena, you know. Ares is good, but he must submit to Athena's will because she makes strategic decisions. She's smart. She sees the big picture. She might be impotent because she's a female. She won't be able to fight in the way that you are. But there must be a relationship here where you work together. And both must be honored. It can't be disrespectful. Absolutely fascinating. Now, another really weird thing, and this is where you start getting into the crazy, crazy realm, is that the right brain is able to recognize faces, whereas the left brain can't. The right brain is centered for most of the richest emotions, whereas the left brain isn't. The right brain is more empathetic, whereas the left brain is less empathetic. It's more cold and Terminator mode. Now, that's absolutely frightening, because then this right brain, this general, that's not your conscious reality, it's sitting there beside you or around you, whatever you want to say, is actually more in touch and relating with the world better and actually gets what's going on. The perfect word for this is more in touch with reality. Literally through the felt experience, it gets it more, it feels reality more, and it has a sense of people more. And you can imagine the general stands out and he speaks to 1,000 soldiers and he gets a sort of hunch about the nature of the collective army. He gets a feeling about what's going on. This is precisely what this left brain is talented at, or is not talented at. It cannot do. It's a bit dead and frozen and stiff. You can imagine that perhaps this is what Jung was suggesting by the idea of the collective unconscious. You get all these little triggers that flood into your right brain and it super processes them and then presents it to you in some type of intelligent way, which is frightening, but it is literally what the evidence is showing us. There's a separate intelligence that has this sort of style of processing that we're not used to, and it can do incredible things for us. And we are fools to dismiss this at this point. It's so, so clear. Now, this all relates to the individuation process then, because precisely what is wrong for most people is that they're stuck in their ego. They're like, I need a purpose. I need to become an individual. They even read individuation. They mix it all up. It's like, I'll construct myself out of jargon and become a perfect individual. And they obsess about all this stuff. But of course, the true meaning of Jung's individuation, when you jiggle it a little bit, when you drop the jargon and the words, is you see that he's basically just saying you need to develop a correct and healthy relationship with this right brain, this unconscious, the soldier and the general. It's incredibly simple. Ares, Athena, Christ and the Lord. It's very, 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 very simple. Very simple. And the procedures are actually extremely simple as well. They're ones you've all heard before. If you were a Buddhist, you would have been individuating by going and hanging out with Buddha, and he tells you to meditate and turn off the mental chatter. You hang out with someone from you go to Jung and all that, and he gets you to get in touch with your more, you could say, more visual artistic side or felt side. He would try to get you more in touch with the anima, the more difficult part. He tries to push you into your unconscious. You do it with modern therapists. They're often get you to dig into your past. So did you get a connection with this stuff that's not sort of obsessing about your day-to-day to-do list and all this type of stuff? The procedures are extremely simple, and they do work if you do them consistently. I guess the reason why we're having a mental health crisis is because we're in a paradigm that refuses to sort of accept these things. Buddhism and meditation probably do the best because they have a sort of science to them. We've sort of deified them. But of course, stuff like, as much as we hate to admit it, stuff like Christianity and prayer sounds perfectly rational from this perspective. You're sitting down, you're submitting your will to the will of God and speaking to it. That's perfectly healthy and normal. Think about what Islam means. Islam means surrender to the will of Allah. That's what Islam means, surrender. Prayer, same thing. You're becoming this soldier. You're becoming the healthy participant in the right brain's bigger picture. That's so scary for people because the ego must be humbled. But the ego, when humbled, becomes so much more effective. And this is a very important thing to understand. And of course, when you look at someone who's well integrated, you could say, they almost have a schizophrenic relationship to themselves. Jung was someone included. He used to write letters to his anima. It's like, what? What are you doing, bro? Talking to girls inside your head. You're a freak. But of course, you talk to even a talented person like Hemingway, and certainly Jung was talented. Someone like Hemingway, he talks about his writing process. You talk to an impotent, Redditeer writer who's got writer's block, and he's like, oh, I'm a perfectionist. I can't get anything done. It's like he's trying to do things and he thinks that he's the perfectionist, he's the soldier, and that's all that exists. He has no ability to give himself over to the erupting creative spirit inside of himself. Well, his mistake. Whereas something like Hemingway is like, no, I get drunk and I write and then I edit when I'm sober. I have a schizophrenic relationship to myself. I'm two people when I'm trying to create stuff. First, I produce energy that's generalized and potent and animated and vibrant. And then I craft that energy with my savage, terminating, ruthless predator mode, Rambo. And that is the correct relationship, a team working together. The general setting the plan or setting the impetus or setting the first principle, setting the mission. And then the ego, the critic, shaping it afterwards. And lastly, and this is what is so fascinating about this, is the connotations this has for the sort of philosophical stuff that all, like, everybody's wasting their time on, because they're not competent enough, nor do they have a solid psychological paradigm to understand what they're even trying to do. Because if you get into philosophy, if you get into religion, if you get into Twitter, if you get into Reddit, and you don't understand how your mind affects your perceptions, you're going to do what the left brain does, which is get caught up in these egotistical little jargonized rants and thinking that you're making some type of progress when you're really just wasting your time. You're wasting actually everybody's time. You're just making, like a load of Windows updates that are just blathering on and doing nothing. And that's your issue. You are making a mistake. But of course, if you come from this paradigm and see the nature of our mind clearly for what it is, and then reapproach these things like religion and philosophy, they're vibrant and they're alive. They're so much more profound because you're coming from the right perspective. If you're coming from this perspective where I just need to jiggle around and argue hard enough and the best arguments win, you're going to fail because you don't know how your mind is influenced by this other part of yourself. Your psychology, your principles of psychology are wrong. But of course, when you look at this stuff and you see what is going on, you see that inside all of us, there's this other brain that has this sort of generalized superior intelligence, it seems, or at the very least, a more general and in touch with reality intelligence. And we are merely deployed by this energy, it seems, or whatever we call we. This ego is a deployment to create this concept of individuality so that we act effectively in the world. And what you start to see then is this sort of difference in perception. Of course, people always talk about God is dead, and they get mad at Nietzsche for doing this type of stuff. But you think about what happened with this whole death of God thing. What really happened is our conception of the world turned into this idea that the universe is a dead machine. Now, that's very interesting because that's precisely what the cold, terminating left brain would think. It would see the universe as a frozen machine with a set of steps and missions that you must participate in. It sees it like a computer. And of course, you see all these people getting obsessed about artificial intelligence as creating God. It's like all tied in that type of sense. But of course, the right brain, as we saw in that video, has this different perception of reality, and it's tied to this perception of reality that is also theistic. Now, that's very, very fascinating. Why would that be? Well, of course, reality is alive when you perceive it. Now, of course, this part of our brain, the right brain, the unconscious, is more in touch with reality than this left brain that creates this concept of the dead machine. And it feels the world as alive. Now, this is precisely Nietzsche's critique of religion, of the modern Western paradigm. We are going into this sort of hell, he said, for about 200 years, where we've got a philosophical first principle that is wrong. Our conception of God was wrong. We're going to kill him because we're moving towards left brainism, if you will. We're becoming too conscious. And what we need to do is get back in touch with the true nature of the world. So you assume that Nietzsche is an atheist, but of course, what Nietzsche often references is people like Spinoza, is this constant assertion that all that reality is energy, or maybe you could understand it as the will to power. And of course, this is way, way closer to the understanding of the right brain. This is what Buddha comes back to us and says. You turn off the ego, and what you will do is you will have this boundary dissolving experience, like on psychedelics, a boundary dissolving experience where you connect with the world and understand the true nature of things and understand that everything is flux. Heraclitus, Nietzsche's favorite philosopher, says the exact same thing. There is nothing permanent except change. Nietzsche got so mad at the Christians, not necessarily Big J, but the Christians, because they gathered in their little monasteries and little cathedrals and all this, and they sat around with their book. And what is the left brain really good at? Words. And so they focused their energy on this sort of book. They sort of made themselves word thinkers, left brainers. They made themselves super conscious, egotistical people. And over a long period of time, that egotism, that super consciousness, that left brainism got so strong in the West that it, of course, gave us the ability to do what we're doing now, which is create something like science, highly rational science. But of course, it cut off everything that was, you could say, religious, the substructures that held it up, which led us into our problem now, where we think that we're this one unified ego inside of our head. It's all connected. It is definitely all connected. And Nietzsche was saying that our way out of this was when we reconnect with this energetic understanding of the world. It'll be a philosophical redemption. He was terrified that this is going to be an unconscious process that's going to play it out. And these things play themselves out with our lives, with our blood, with our death. And he was absolutely crazy. Correct. Wars kicked off very soon after he was around. And of course, what he's trying to point you towards, and what he always has been trying to point you towards, is that there's an energetic world out there that we need to base our philosophical principles on. And people, because they're incompetent, would argue about philosophy and be like, I don't think Nietzsche is right and all this, or I think he's a mean guy, I think he got syphilis and all this. It's like, it's absolutely fine, but the science is in. The hard 200 years that we went through has now born a fruit of sorts. and we've dug into the mind in a materialistic sense and found this division, and it's connecting all of this stuff together. You have Christianity with the intelligence of prayer, Buddha with the intelligence of meditation, Heraclitus, the ancient Greeks, Nietzsche, all of it connects. And of course, what you have with Carlos Jesus the Youngest is the assertion that this can be managed. The problem you're having is a psychological problem, and this can be actually overcome with this set of processes such as individuation, such as putting together rituals that subvert the ego and all this. And you see us, we're craving this. This is why everybody loves psychedelics, but there's more to it than just psychedelics. It's a very, very specific process that can be done in a very, very simple way. And it all fits perfectly. It's all absolutely fascinating. And of course, we have a lot of these things resurrecting themselves in the modern age. I've been doing this one-on-one with people and getting great results with just simply getting people to enter back into their energetic body and their emotions and their reality. It's quite simple. It just works on principle, you know? So if you were interested in doing that with me, and I'm like shilling at the top of this, I'm like, oh, paradigm changes. And I'm like, all right, here's some stuff now. Capitalism comes back in. But if you want, you can work one-on-one with me. I'll leave a link down below. If you want, I'll have a podcast, premium podcast, over on the Uberboyo site where you can listen to more details about this individuation process that Jung talks about. And of course, there is music I make as well if you want to listen to that. If you're kind of sick of listening to me talk, you're listening to my left brain, you can hear my right brain scream and be like, let me free, this guy's a tyrant in holding me back. All right, so there's all those options up for you there. Thank you very much for watching and listening. I hope you're just sitting there having a schizophrenic break right now after watching this video. I've weird hopes. I'm a weird dude. All right, people, I'll talk to you later. Bye bye.